Get into the minds of the most influential and successful creatives on the planet. From EDM record labels, club owners, EDM event producers, music industry lawyers, managers, EDM recording artists, and key industry leaders. They are all part of the story when the DJ takes the stage. They push more than buttons for everything you need to know about the EDM dance music scene. You need this podcast right now. Welcome to the Mastermind of a DJ podcast, hosted by Naughty Natalia.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to episode number 4 of the Mastermind of a DJ podcast with yours truly, Naughty Natalia. Now, our show is powered by a venue that is a must-see when in South Florida. That place? Vixen's Cabaret. Now, they've booked some of the most recognizable names in dance music and have created nightclub experiences that are truly unforgettable in Davie, Florida, which is only minutes from downtown Fort Lauderdale and the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino. Now, stay tuned to the end of our show as we'll announce the next big DJ set to perform at Vixen's Cabaret. So what does being a fully certified chef and a dance music DJ have in common? One is creating food to consume that releases the pleasure endorphins in the body, and the other is creating frequencies that vibe with your soul. Combine the two and you get my next guest. This is the creme de la creme of DJs, and his start was in the late 80s, winning first place in the Switzerland's National DJ Championship, to moving to Miami, owning residencies at the infamous Space, Opium, Nikki Beach, and more, to even hosting audiences such as Madonna, U2, Prince, Lenny Kravitz, Mick Jagger, Jamie Foxx, and P. Diddy. And yes, the list will go on. This worldwide DJ, producer, record label owner is highly respected among the industry. So grabbing him for some good old Italian food and espressos, well, I mean, that's how you capture a man's heart, right? And at least I got him for the interview you are about to hear. Let's get into the mind of Ivano Bellini. But Ivano Bellini is sitting down with me right now. We're at this fantastic little restaurant called Silvano.
Silvano,
yeah. In Miami.
It's an institution.
It's an institution. And let me tell you, I just had some of the best pasta I've had in a very long time.
It's not fancy, it's not, you know, bells and whistles, but it's good, real Italian food. The pasta has always been great here.
Yeah, and you know, coming from someone who's a trained culinary chef as yourself, you would kind of have the right kind of palate, or someone that I can go to and say, Ivano, is this good or not? Is this good pasta? And you can tell me yay or nay.
I know pasta.
I know pasta.
There's not many things I know. But pasta, I definitely know. I grew up on eating pasta the way it's supposed to be, you know, made with love, al dente. Mm. It's pasta.
So here we are talking about pasta, when in fact we should be talking about music, right? You need to know something. I've known Ivano for close to 20 years, and we never had the chance to break bread together like this. I mean, it's pretty cool. I'd rather our conversations would always be in the DJ booth, and you're screaming at each other and hugging and hi and kiss and all that. But we never really had the intimate conversation like we're having now. And food in Ivano's world is a religion in itself. I mean, it carries the same kind of significance as his music. And no worries, I do pivot and get into music, but I mean, who doesn't like talking about food? And so sitting down with you to get to know you, your history, how you came to be, you know, you're still working within this industry. You are still, you know, even just last night, you know, at one of the most sought after clubs to even be able to DJ in. You're an icon. You're legendary. You're someone who people look up to as far as the sound and putting in the hours, the time and the sweat equity to make it happen.
You know who makes fun of me like that?
Who?
Who always calls me legend?
Who?
Luis D.
He's going to hear this, so.
Oh, yeah. He always makes fun of me. You're a legend.
Yeah.
We're kidding. I love Luis. He's awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah.
That's so funny.
So when sometimes when I call him or I say I do it, he's like, oh, cool. I was like, yeah, it's become a, I'm a legend. So
you're a legend.
I'm playing with his, play.
His play. Oh, yeah. All right. So let's get into the history of Ivano Bellini. You were born in Puy, Switzerland.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a tiny little, it used to be a tiny little town. Now it's a chic suburb of a bigger city called Lausanne.
And that's where you moved when you were 9 years old?
9 years old, yeah.
Yeah. Which is also known now as the Olympic City.
Yeah. That's where the Olympic, World Olympic Committee and the Olympic Museum.
Right.
It's the Olympic City.
Right. And so you were there till 9 years old. And then, which is also, I guess, Lausanne. Lausanne is also known as, like you said, the suburbs. Your father opened up a restaurant there.
Yeah.
Give us some insight on what your father's life was like.
My father was a chef restaurateur. So all my life, he was either working in a restaurant or managing a restaurant. Mm-hmm. Or at that time, when I turned 9 years old, he actually bought a restaurant. So he became a restaurant owner and was a whole family thing because my mom started working in there too. And it's restaurant hours are rough. Cafe and restaurant and in Switzerland, restaurants are open for lunch and then they have a little break and then they open for dinner. Mm-hmm. And when you're a chef, you're there for lunch and you go early, like at 9:30, maybe 10 to do the prep. Mm-hmm. And then you go back at 9 and the restaurant is open until 10. You're still a bit longer and stuff like that. So for pretty much all my life, it's not the regular hours that most kids are used to as far as seeing their parents. You know, most parents do 9 to 5 and they're home every night for dinner. My father wasn't like that because he was working. Mm-hmm. So most nights it was my sister, my mom and I and my father. We used to have dinner together on his day off, which was either Sunday or Monday. It depends. And so that's how I grew up. Mm-hmm. You know, my father being not there at home every night, but when he was there, he was actually making a point of cooking for us. And it was every week when it happened. It was like a mini event.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
And then, you know, as a kid, when you go eat, back then was still a special thing. You would not go eat in a restaurant every day. But you didn't have the money or it was something special. So every time when I was a kid, I used to go eat where my father was working. Yeah. It was like a huge deal.
Yeah,
we were eating in a restaurant because most of the time you were eating home. As I was telling you before, I grew up eating good food.
Good food.
Food was special in my home. Whether my father was there, whether it was my mom cooking, food was special.
And what does food mean for you? Because we had a really beautiful conversation about that. And share that with our listeners. Like, what does it really mean for you?
It's a heritage, my Italian heritage. My father being Italian and the whole family. And it's mostly around the Mediterranean. And all the cultures, the countries, it's about the same. Food is more than just nourishing. It's more than just something you put in your body to function. Food is love. Food is life. Food is something you make with love and you hopefully share with people you love. You break bread, you share wine, you toast, you sit around the table with your family, your friends. You don't rush. You try to appreciate the food and the people around.
And the moment.
And the moment. And it makes it's part of the culture.
Do you feel that way when you are DJing? Do you have that same feeling?
sometimes, yes.
Okay.
And sometimes, no. It depends the place. It depends the people. It depends if it's a club and the people actually came to hear you play, or if it's more of a lounge and the music is more in the background, then you don't have that same connection with the people when the music is in the background than when people are actually in front of you dancing, looking at you, listening to everything you put out the speakers and watching your every move. Then there's a whole different connection.
Yeah. Okay.
I try to do my craft with love all the time. I make a point. This is a craft. This is a passion. This is what I've been doing for the past 35 years professionally and even longer than that. So I try to put myself into my craft and I make a point of it.
So your mom was Swiss and she was working with your father and taking care of you guys.
Yes.
You have a sister.
Yes. Little sister.
Yeah. What's her name?
Katia.
Katia. Yeah. And where does she live?
Switzerland. She's still there.
Yeah.
She takes care of all the social media platforms and outputs of theater.
Really?
Yes. In my hometown, in Lausanne, she loves what she's doing. She's always been also very artistic. She went to a theater school when she was much younger. She's not acting, but she's working in the industry.
Yeah.
And she the good thing is that she can do a lot of it from home. No, she's super happy. And on the side, she's a drummer in a two-piece band.
What?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
She drums.
That is so freaking cool.
With her ex-boyfriend, and they remain best friend. He's a singer, guitar player, and they do southern blues rock thing.
Yeah.
And she plays the drums, sings the background. And so she's, let's say she's 110 pounds wet. Maybe 105. I mean, she's skinny.
Wow.
So you have that tiny little skinny girl.
Oh my God.
Banging the drums, and she bangs. I mean,
yeah.
she's it's awesome. And I went to see them live, and so she's also in the, you know, artistic
music circuit.
Music, whatever artistic there is. I'm really proud of what she's doing.
Look at you. You're all blushing now, talking about your little sister.
She's my baby sister.
So that's awesome, though, because that connection for music is there. You guys have that connectivity about the craft in itself.
What was funny is that when we grew up, and it's because I was so much into club music and DJing and stuff like that, my sister couldn't stand this kind of music.
Mm.
She was more into, you know, acoustic and folk and, you know, completely on the other side of the spectrum of disco and house music and clubbing. She used to hate clubbing. She went a couple of times here and there, but that wasn't at all her scene.
Yeah.
And
how does she feel about you being who you are and what you're doing?
Oh, I guess she's she's proud of her big brother.
Has she got to see you perform?
Oh, yeah. She used to see me perform every day when I was home, when I was practicing. I used to drive her crazy with the music at home. Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Boom.
I can imagine.
You know, her and my mom, they were the first one to see me, you know, practicing at home, doing my set for myself and doing my my radio shows and myself and my friends, you know, on cassette and stuff like that.
The good
they
old
saw
cassette.
Me before anybody else saw me. I've been very fortunate to have been able to do what I love to do for the past, I mean, whole my life, for the past 35, 36 years. It's special. It's special. I know a lot of people can't claim the same. Mm-hmm. You know, as you were saying, when you love what you do,
you never work a day in your life.
And I haven't worked.
I love hearing stories about how DJs have evolved in the industry in EDM. In today's day and age, everything is downloadable and almost seems untouchable. I mean, back then, we could actually hold our 12-inch vinyls at a record store or cassette tapes to CDs. But before all of that, there were 45s. I mean, I remember that when I was like 5 years old. Oh my gosh. Ever heard of those? Well, Ivano has. And you know what's even cooler? It's his story about him and a jukebox.
My parents were, you know, into music, so they were buying records here and there. My father was a jazz lover, so he had some jazz records at home. We had a system to play music and then a turntable with, you know, those big cabinet speakers that we used to have. And so I started buying and collecting from friends or family that didn't want theirs and those little records since I'm very young. And then, as I told you, you know, when I was 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, instead of asking for G.I. Joes for birthdays or stuff like that, I was, you know, asking for records, an LP of the Rolling Stones, an LP of ABBA. I still have them, by the way.
Really?
Oh, yeah, you better believe
it. Nice.
So And then I started to collect a lot of records to go back to when my father bought the restaurant. As I told you, there was a cafe on the ground floor and the restaurant on top. And in the cafe, there was a jukebox. So there was a company or a guy that does, you know, fill up the jukebox for you. He comes every week or every couple of weeks to put the new records.
And that's the 45s,
that's
right?
That's the 45s.
Oh, wow.
And then when he removes the records, he doesn't know what to do, because when they're not good enough to be in a jukebox anymore, it means they're old. So instead of throwing them away or whatever, I was there every time he was coming to refresh the jukebox, and I would keep the 45s. So I started to build, from 9 years old on, I started to build a pretty nice collection of 45s.
How many 45s would you say you have in your possession right now?
A couple of hundreds.
What?
Yeah, I used to have more. I used to have a whole bunch, but I still have a couple of hundreds.
Can you mix on those now?
That
would be pretty cool to see.
One of my best friends, it's the friend that I've been in contact with for the longest time, because we knew each other from 9, 10 years old. So he was a year older, and he was also a DJ, and he still DJs, and he's probably, as far as musical knowledge, he's, to me, the person who has the most musical knowledge as far as all kinds of music.
Nice.
I mean, his musical brain is insane. Yeah. And he does parties with only 45s.
Get out of here.
Yeah, not all the time.
Yeah.
He does all kinds of parties. He plays with, you know, with Serato and vinyl and stuff. But sometimes he does parties with just 45s. When he came here to Miami a few years ago on vacation, we went to the record stores. Uh-huh. The only thing he was looking for were 45s. Old soul records, all 60s and 70s records.
Yeah.
45s. That's all he wanted to buy. And he bought a whole bunch.
What was happening then?
Well, I did the first time I ever played music for a crowd.
Yeah.
It was for the Christmas party of my school.
Okay.
Where we did a whole production. It was the year Grease came out, so it was very Grease oriented, if you want. So in Grease, there's always a radio jock. I mean, there's music and stuff. So we did something a little bit in that kind of stuff. So I played a bunch of records, one turntable, no mixing. Mm-hmm. You know, you play a record, you take the needle out. I mean, the arm, you put the next one, and people thought it was the
best thing since sliced bread.
I mean, because we didn't have that, because we were too young to win clubs, and it was a time when MTV didn't exist yet. There was no real music programs on TV, on the radio a little bit, and so having that in front of you and being able to dance. So I did this one, and then I did my friend's birthday party, and then another friend's birthday party with the same thing. I used to borrow my parents' sound equipment.
That must have been heavy.
Yeah, and I didn't have a car then.
How did you get the stuff over to you?
We'll manage.
Yeah.
Right? Don't worry.
When
you want something, you make it happen. When there's a will, there's a way. We used to carry it a few blocks down. A bunch of friends. One was carrying a speaker, the other one a speaker, and then an amplifier, and then the turntable. And we made it happen. So I did a couple of birthday parties for friends, and then people started to like it. And then I had requests from a friend's brother or a friend's cousin to do his or hers. And then I started to charge a little bit of money, not to make money, but so I could, you know, reinvest and buy some equipment, buy a turntable for me so I didn't have to borrow my parents and a couple of speakers and so on and so on and so on and so on. And that's how I started.
Wow. How much were you charging at the time?
$50.
$50.
Yeah, you know, or maybe $30 or maybe $50. It was nothing, you know. It was the parents paying for their kids, you know, birthday or stuff like that. So it wasn't a lot of money, but I could buy a couple of records. If I do two events, I can buy a turntable and so on and so on and so on.
So you already created the business sense during that time to be like, look, I have to start reinvesting even this $30 that I'm making.
I had to. My parents, I mean, I didn't grow up, you know, in a rich family.
The more that I sit with this legend of a producer, record label owner, and DJ, the more I feel connected to him. I mean, it's like chatting with an old friend and hearing his side of the story about his upbringing. And the saying is really true in this case. I mean, you guys see all the glory, but you don't know the story. And his story is real genuine. After the break, we get into how Ivano built a business and did it with his crew. Yep, you'll be introduced to Alang, Luigi, Ivan, and Nicholas, who, along with Ivano, were already making some serious cash and did it in their teens. Now talk about taking matters into your own hands.
You're listening to the Mastermind of a DJ podcast with Naughty Natalia. We'll be right back after this.
Vixen's Cabaret is leading the way in creating unforgettable nightclub experiences in the Broward County area. They're only minutes from the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in downtown Fort Lauderdale at 3050 Burris Road in Davie, Florida. It's your naughty girl, Natalia, and have you ever wondered what a sexy circus would be like? I feel they have broken the barrier. Better yet, broken the stigma of adult entertainment by booking some of the biggest names in the EDM industry, from Marcus Schultz, Damaged Goods, Lavelle Dupree, and more. Now imagine walking into a sexy circus of jaw-dropping live aerial acrobatic entertainment, live fire shows, and more while listening to your favorite EDM beats. It's dope! The Sexy Circus is so good that they're going official with a new brand of Sexy Circus, and that is set to launch December 3rd and 4th with Mr. Gray on the decks. Now, this is going to be a two-day event you won't want to miss. It's a sensory overload of pleasure. Now, listen to the end of the podcast to find out who will be the next big-name DJ that's set to perform at Vixen's Cabaret.
Welcome back to the Mastermind of a DJ podcast with your host, Naughty Natalia.
I didn't open. I took
over.
We took it over. We didn't open. The club was there. Because the club had been there for many, many years.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it just happened that the owner lost his operating license, which means he couldn't sell alcohol anymore. And he was trying to sell the club. So from the day that he lost his license until he sold the club, my friends and I, my best friend just happened to be this club owner's nephew. So that's how we had the connection. And we were hanging out in the club, even though we're not supposed to because we were underage. But because when you know the owner, it's always a little bit easier.
Yeah, sure.
And who cares? Anyway, so we used to hang out in the club all the time. Mm-hmm. So when myself, my couple of best friends, and a bunch of friends were hanging out over there because that was the only club we could go to because we were all underage. We could not go to any other club. So we're all very happy to have one place that we can hang out for free, basically. Yeah. Imagine we're not working, still in school. So you can go out. We could get in. We didn't have to pay a cover. We knew the owner. It was cool. So when he lost his license and he could not employ and pay the people the same amount of money, because of course when you can sell alcohol, the numbers at the door not the same.
Right.
So he asked us, his nephew and his two best friends, myself and another friend, if we wanted to run the club for a few months until he could sell it. And so I was not even 16, and none of my friends were. We were all the same age. We were between 15 and 16, and we ran this club for about 8 months. And because he lost the liquor license, instead of being 18 and over, he could go now to 16 and over, which means all our friends could come. So we ran the club and we ran it really good. I mean, we were club managers at 15.
All right, so let's go back to that moment. So you guys have the keys to heaven, basically.
Pretty much.
Right? And you're in charge of music because obviously, you know, you're already in that obsessive state behind the DJ booth all the time.
Exactly.
Watching, you know, your past mentors and people that you had looked up to in the industry. Then you had your, it's kind of like was it three or four guys?
It was three. There was a couple of other ones. I mean, we were a whole group, but the main core was three guys.
Right, three guys. And what are their names?
One is called Alain, and the other one was purely Italian. His name was Luigi. It's true.
I love it. Luigi. And then the other?
Oh, then it was Ivan, and then there was Nicholas, who was in charge of the security. And there's a whole group of friends. I mean, I go down those were
the main core crew. Okay, so Alain, what was he running?
The money, because he was about to become a banker, which he still is right now. I mean, he's in business, in finance.
Got it. Luigi
was running the bar and all the supplies because his father was in that line of work. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Ivan was running all the special events, the shows that we were doing. We had dancers and stuff like that.
Okay, so he was like promotions.
He was in theater and production and stuff like that.
Nicholas?
Security. He was the muscle. He was a black belt, a brown belt, judo, Swiss champion thing. He was the muscle.
So no one fucked around with him. Okay.
No.
So this is kind of like the perfect group of guys.
It just happened.
The destination to heaven has been determined.
Yeah.
The keys have been handed over.
Yeah.
And now the club starts. The club is called Saint-Tropez.
Saint-Tropez, yeah.
Saint-Tropez?
Yeah, which is short for Saint-Tropez. Okay. Saint-Tropez.
Okay. All right. So you have Alan, Luigi, Ivan, Nicolas, and then we have Ivano.
Yes.
You guys are still friends.
We're still friends. And I was trying to find this picture because we have a picture, uh-huh. the four of us, Alan, Luigi, uh-huh. Ivan, and I. Nicolas was not on the picture. In front of the club. Back then, 1980.
Yeah.
I have that picture, and I wanted to show it to you, but I.
Okay.
And then we did. We had a dinner a few mm-hmm. years ago, and we took a picture, and we juxtaposed one on yeah. top of the other.
Yeah.
It's too funny. Less hair and a few more pounds, but we still look okay.
You're still friends to
We're
this
still
day.
Still friends.
And that's the thing. It's but it's people like that who are by your side in your corner as you started progressing into what you're doing as a DJ. So now it leads me to this. So here you are. You're still in Switzerland. When did you move to the state? When did this move happen? Or what was going on? Like, were you already DJing in Ibiza? Like,
No. But the traveling DJ thing started way later. Okay. Mm-hmm. To go back a few years, I started working in running this club. Working
right.
This. I knew then after, you know, doing it for 6 months, 8 months, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a DJ. But back then, and especially in Switzerland, maybe in other countries where that club music scene was more popular, DJ could be a career, especially if you were able to do radio and club and stuff like that. But where I grew up, DJ was a hobby. It was some dude who was playing a bunch of records in a club. So it wasn't a career path that you could do for a long time.
Yeah.
So my parents told me I needed to get some kind of real world education, and then afterwards I can do whatever I wanted. But have a so I went to culinary school, as I was telling you before, because it was the easiest path to
complete what you had promised.
Yeah, to complete it. Yeah, because it was in the family business. I didn't have mm-hmm. to study too much, so I could spend more time, you know, DJing and spending hours mixing, practicing instead of studying how to cook, because I knew already most of it, mm-hmm. Enough of it. So that's what I did. And then I started, as soon as I was done with my culinary school, I started DJing full time.
And that was 3 years. And your parents gave you, like you mentioned, an ultimatum.
Yes. They told me, you know, it's easy. It's either you study something, anything, but from the real world, you know, mm-hmm. electrician, plumber, mm-hmm. whatever you want. Go to school, mm-hmm. study math, study...
Whatever.
But do something that's going to give you a foundation for the rest of your life. If the DJ thing doesn't work, or if mm-hmm. after a few years that's not what you want to do, at least you have an education.
Right.
And we help you, and you stay home, and
right.
so on. Or you go and you become a DJ right now, but you get out of the house.
Wow.
You know, I thought about it for a few minutes, and I was like, I have it pretty good at home, you know,
yeah.
I don't have to pay rent. I mean, I knew that even if I wanted to be a DJ, it would take me a bunch of years getting a resume of you know, working here and there, and before I could find a permanent residence where I could actually make enough money to survive.
Right.
So getting out of, you know, getting kicked out of the home, of the family home at 16 with no, you know, prospect, mm-hmm. just the love of music would have been a little bit risky.
And that's
really risky.
And that's important because that's what's happening right now with a lot of up and coming DJs. They don't have a foundation. They think, you know, I want to be the guy that I see on social media, but they don't understand their sweat equity behind it.
Sweat equity. You said that before. I love that that expression. Yes, and but now you know that you can build a career out of it. DJ is an actual career. I'm not saying it's easy or it's made for everybody, but you can actually build a career. You can be a club DJ and be very successful.
Yeah.
1982 was a completely different story. 1982 in Switzerland was a completely different story. Had it been now presented with the same situation or the same ultimatum, maybe I would have taken the other route.
Mm.
I don't know. But back then...
There was no other way to go.
Yeah. I mean, the other way would have been highly risky, and I probably would have come back home 3 months later with my tail between my legs.
but you know what, though? I think what your parents did and how the viewpoint on education, though, it's... growing up, for me, I grew up in a very poor upbringing. You know, unfortunately, my mother was terminally ill all my life until she died. So I didn't have... Ivano, I never had anyone tell me, go to school. Like, I dropped out of school to work. You know what I was doing? I was I was rapping and being a break dancer in LA.
Well, that's all right.
Okay. And then working at Taco Bell. But then I went to school. But that's the thing. It's like, you know, it's like you do what you can and you make it work. And your mindset was, I have a foundation. Parents are willing to allow me to give me that space to grow and be this musical genius. And you made that decision. It was a right decision.
Of course it was the right decision. And of course my parents were right to give me that ultimatum and warning me to have some kind of real world education.
Yeah.
Of course they were right. Right. They were, I mean, at the moment, of course, you're 16, you think you know everything, and you're like, you know, I hate my parents. But of course, they were right, and I'm really happy. And those 3 years went by really quick when you're trying to do three things at the same time. You know, you're studying, and then I was playing soccer all the time, and then I was DJing every little hour time that I was, that free time that I had, whether it was home and doing a little party here, a little party there. So, I mean, it went by so quick. Next thing I knew, it was 3 years later, I was a licensed
culinary chef.
Culinary chef, and I complied with my part of the bargain. So then I could, you know, go to my parents and say, okay, you know, I did that. Now I'm going to be a DJ. And they were like, eh, that's it. Good for you.
Fair deal.
Yeah.
Fair deal.
So I stayed home, you know, as I was telling you, I did a couple of clubs, replacements, you know, filling up for friends who were vacation over here and there to build a little bit of a resume. And then a few months later, I got my first residency, and that was it.
Where was that?
Small club compared to now. But back then, it was a medium-sized club in my hometown in Lausanne, and that was my first residency. I was working there because the residency back then, you were working at a club 6 nights a week.
Yeah.
In the same club. And then you were playing Tuesday and Wednesday, and most of the time Tuesday and Wednesday there was three people hanging around, and it was part of, you know, making your sweat.
Yeah, your sweat equity.
My sweat equity of playing for the walls, you know, Tuesday and Wednesday. So Thursday there was a little bit of people, and then Friday, Saturday was fun because the club would be packed. But sweat equity, playing for the walls for...
Yeah.
To build your craft.
And that's the thing. I think that's what a lot of DJs and those up and coming in this industry need to understand is that you don't just come out of the floodgates.
Yeah.
Like, you have to expect to know that you're going to have moments when there's no one on the dance floor, but that's the perfect opportunity to build your craft and practice and practice,
right? That's part of the job. Okay, if you're lucky, you need a couple of lucky breaks in any kind of life. And, you know, if you can, you know, your first club or your second club, you work and it's a cool club and there's a lot of people, but that's not the norm. The norm is for the 98% of cases, you have to play in shit clubs or shit parties, shit equipment, and that's how you build your craft. And then little by little, you build a name, you build a following. Now with social media, it's a whole different story. You can have a following even before you even do one club date. Couldn't do that back then.
Yeah.
As I was growing up and as I was DJing and I was studying and stuff, I used to go out on Friday and Saturday with my friends. We used to go out. And my idea before I became a professional DJ, before I was I was a resident, is I wanted to DJ in all the cool clubs where I used to go as a patron, as a club goer. Mm-hmm. So we used to go in the coolest club. We used to even take our car and drive for an hour to go to this place because it was a really cool club there. Yeah. And so when I used to go there with my friends, I was in this big club. I was like, one day I'm going to play in this club. And my friends, they knew I was DJing, but for them to see me DJ there was a big step. So a couple of ones knew that I had the drive to do it, and some were like, yeah, sure, of course. You know, they were making fun of me. The 5 years that I was DJing in Switzerland professionally, that's what I did. I ended up playing in all the clubs that, as a younger myself, I used to go as a patron and love the club and say, one day I'm going to work in this club. And I did. And then to answer your question, when I got to the US, is because in Switzerland I had done my tours. I could have kept going there, still do the same clubs as my friends were DJs were doing, and you still keep playing in those clubs, and once in a while they open a new club and you work in the club. But Switzerland is a small country, and I did the tour. I did what I had set up to do, play in those clubs, and I played in all of them.
You completed your vision
my vision.
Yeah.
I always knew that I wanted to travel, that I wanted to see what the world was. And so my cousin had moved to, he was in Switzerland. He had moved back to South America because his father was in South America, mm-hmm. in Ecuador. So he had moved there and we were kept in contact. And he was like, well, come here, come hang out, the stuff that we can do here. So one day I'm like, I'm leaving. And I went to South America. I didn't know if I was going for 2 months, 3 months, a year, 10 years. Yeah. But I went there. I was like, I want to see something else. I knew I could go back to Switzerland and start working the next day. Uh-huh. So it wasn't like, it's a departure, but it was a calculated risk.
How do you survive in those risks? Did you have money set aside?
I had a little bit of money, but not a ton because, you know, yeah. I was DJing. I was making okay money. Uh-huh. I was saving a little bit, but I was young, so I had a really nice car.
Yeah.
A car that was probably too expensive for my means.
Uh-huh.
But you're 20, you're 21, 22, you're a DJ, you want to have a nice car. So I have a really nice car.
Yeah, of course.
I had a convertible in Switzerland when you can only use a convertible. I mean, put the roof down maybe 3 months out of 12 because the rest of the time it's too cold.
Yeah.
But I didn't give a fuck. I wanted to have a cool car. Anyway, so I had a little bit of money. I went there, but my cousin lived there. His dad was the owner of a hotel, restaurant, casino. So I went there. I had a room in his apartment that was taken care of. So it was a calculated risk. It's not like I mm-hmm. went with my backpack and I said, we'll see what happened. So I went there, visited the country, learned the language, hung out, stuff like that. We did a couple of things. We did a couple of events. We did a couple of concerts. Worked with the industry there. But it was nice. It was great. It was a cultural shock because when you go from Switzerland to Ecuador, it's a whole...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
It's a whole different story. And then one day we were there. We had made a little bit of money doing promoting a show or something. And I was like, well, let's go on Christmas vacation. Mm-hmm. And he had been to Miami a couple of times. I had never been to the U.S., never been to Miami. And Miami, of course, from South America is the gateway to the
U.S.
So he's like, let's go to Miami. Let's spend a couple of weeks in Miami.
And
that's how I ended up here.
What year was that?
It was Christmas Eve, 1991.
Look at you.
So we got here. We were supposed to stay here for 3 weeks, like Christmas, New Year, Miami, Orlando, Daytona, back to Miami. We land here Christmas Eve, go to the hotel, drive along Collins Avenue, and it was the afternoon. It was all retirement homes with the retirees on the porch, you know, in the chairs.
Yeah.
And I had never been to Miami. So I look at that. I look at my cousin. I was like, what the hell did you take me? What? Because I was expecting I was expecting to see Miami Vice.
Because
that's
what's promoted.
That's my idea. I mean, Miami Vice is my...
Don Johnson, like your...
It's my favorite TV show of all time. Of all time.
Right.
Anyway, but I was expecting to see that, you know, the cool Ferraris and the chicks in bikinis. And all I see is retirees on porches. And he's like, wait until tonight. It's like, don't
let this fool you.
Yeah. Wait until tonight. So we go have dinner and then we end up the 24th of December. So the night from Christmas Eve to Christmas, we end up at the Clevelander, which back then was one of the hip spots. You gotta imagine 1991. There was four clubs in Miami, five bars and 10 restaurants. Mm-hmm. It was not what it is now, what it has become.
Yeah.
It was happening, but starting to happen. It was mm-hmm. nothing like it is now. So mm-hmm. we go to Clevelander. It's 1 a.m. I'm wearing shorts and a polo. I still can't remember. Shorts and a polo. Coming from Switzerland where, you know, in Christmas, if you're lucky, it's 30 degrees. If you're not lucky, it's in the 20s or in the 10s or it's cold.
Yeah.
There's no way you're wearing shorts and a polo outside. So I'm at the Clevelander. Music is blasting. Girls in bikinis. Mm-hmm. Girls jumping in the pool because back then the pool was still a pool and you can jump in the pool. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? I mean, this is something like you can only see on Miami Vice or on TV. I mean, I was like, what the hell is this? And I look at my cousin and I'm like, this is my kind of place. I'm never leaving. And I told him that. I said, this is my kind of place. I'm staying here. And I did.
That's incredible.
He didn't believe me, but I did. That's how I ended up here.
Game on. So I would say the Christmas gift that Miami received was you. And it all went down at the Clevelander. And you had that defining moment when you planted your flag.
Yeah.
You know, they should have a plaque with your name on it. And have the plaque, like, you know, somewhere on the wall of the hotel of Clevelander and said, Ivano Bellini, planted his flag Christmas Eve, 1991.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to make a phone call on that. I think we should do that. Come on, Ivano. I mean, seriously. Like, you have definitely... You've paid your dues, man.
It was close to 30 years ago, and I remember like it was yesterday.
Okay, so at this point, and let me just paint the picture for you guys, we're already two espressos in, our bellies are filled with the pasta. Oh my God, it was so good. And I'm still pinching myself over the fact that in front of me, I'm getting the exclusive story behind a man who is so well respected within the EDM community. I mean, if you've partied in Miami, like the after hours in Miami, I'm sure Ivano Bellini has been there behind the decks orchestrating the soundtrack to your every move till the sun came up. And this is from like Space Terrace in downtown Miami to probably every single club that has and still is popular to this day. Ivano, I know, has been in your ears. Now, as he proceeded to share his start in the 305, I mean, I had to ask him where some of his first club gigs were at. And before I even get to this next clip, you have to understand something. When Ivano made the decision to stay in Miami on Christmas Eve, he didn't have his collection of vinyl records with him from Switzerland. I mean, all he had was his knowledge of mixing and a beautiful, bright smile. He literally had to reinvent himself all over again because nobody knew who he was in Miami. So how did he do it?
It's where I played last night, which is Treehouse. But Ben, it was called Boomerang.
Wow.
Boomerang is where I played last night. It was the same room.
Get out of here.
Yeah. It was called Boomerang. That place changed name like 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
You know, and it was Boomerang and it was Groove Jet for a long, long time.
Yeah, Groove Jet, that's right. Yeah.
But it was even before Groove Jet. Anyway, so I play there. The DJ let me use his records, you know, because I made kind of hanging out with the manager or the owner. Mm-hmm. And he's like, ask him if you can play with his records. So I play for an hour and I just mix records.
Mm-hmm.
The first paid gig was at a place called Loft. That was my first gig here. I started going there. It was the first Euro chic VIP thing club here in Miami. They're the first one who did the bottle service, the VIP, the ropes at the door.
Yeah.
They're the ones who brought that to Miami. It was called Loft. It was where Liquid used to be.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
But it was called Loft.
Wow.
And so I used to hang out there, you know, here and there. And, and I became friends with the DJ, who was a French guy, who's still my best friend here. We've been friends ever since. And he was a resident there, which means he was working pretty much every night. And then, you know, after hanging out there for a couple of months, he was like, listen, I need someone to work with me on weekends for Friday, Saturday to open for me, maybe close, do the lights when I'm when I'm playing. I'm in. And that's how, that was my first paid gig.
So knowing that you didn't have your vinyl with you, though, I mean, obviously you had to reinvest, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, I as soon as I started working there, I started saving money so I could have my vinyl flown in. I had to start going into record stores here and start, you know, buying records for now. So I was building, you know, or updating my my vinyl collection by buying records. So by the time I started working there, I already had a bunch of vinyls that I could play because I was playing where he was already the resident. I was using his records too. And so it all worked out together. So I worked there for a few months before I could find my own residency.
And so that meant that you had to go out there and hustle, go to other people's parties.
Yeah.
You had to go and support.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that is where I think that sweat equity also kicks in.
It's true.
Because, you know, there's nights where you're like, look, I'm just going to present myself, make friends with the managers, the people who run this place.
Yep.
Right. So it's
the resident DJ and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And this was pre social media. So I mean, I could tell, you know, the owner of a club, listen, I was a DJ in Switzerland. I DJ for 6 years there and all the big clubs. I could invent any kind of story, but there was no way of me proving it unless they had been to the place themselves, which the chance of that was nil. So it's not like you could, you know, show proof of what you have done or clubs. And you had to show by, you know, playing a couple of records or, you know, being insistent enough that they let you play to see what you can do. And then you had, you know, a kind of a live audition and you had to play records for 30 minutes or an hour to show that you can actually put two records together.
Did you ever have anyone reject you and just say, you know, Ivano, not right now?
Oh, yeah, of course.
How did that go? How did you deal with those rejections?
Well, you're a little bit pissed. artist, you're like, this moron doesn't know what he's missing.
Yeah.
But it's part of you know, being rejected in a, especially in an artistic line of work. It's part of what makes you stronger. It's part of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it depends of what your character is, how you built inside. Some people, you know, can't take rejection very well.
Yeah.
And for me, it was only made me want it even more, work harder, prove them wrong, and but also having a short-term memory, telling me like, okay, that was yesterday, it didn't work there,
yeah,
it's gonna work tomorrow, I'm gonna go to another place,
right?
I was confident enough in my skills and my ability to know that at some point I'll be able to get a gig, and it just happened. And it was, you know, that first gig that I had at La Loft, it was half because I built the relationship by going there, hanging out with the DJ, making friends with the resident, mm-hmm. and but also showing that I had the musical knowledge and mm-hmm. the skills, you know, the could play in this club, which back then was a chic club with people coming from Europe. It was full of French and Italians, and
so you already knew the fabric.
Of course I knew the fabric.
Yeah. Again, every DJ, when you're live, right, it's like, even though they know that you can do it, but you're only as good as your last show.
That's true.
It's just how it is, especially on vinyl.
Or as your last record.
It's your last record,
because if you do a really cool set, you know, an hour or 2 hours, and people are dancing, and all of a sudden you put a bomb, I mean, like a dud,
right?
And you empty your dance floor, they're not going to care about the 2 hours prior. They're only going to remember you for that one track that emptied the dance floor.
And then they hold it to you.
Of course.
Of course they do.
It's, what have you done for me lately?
That's right.
And in this business, it's, you're only as good as your last show, and sometimes you're only as good as your last record.
Damn.
And listen, I have no shame of saying I have, thank God, not very often, but I have emptied dance floor with the wrong record. But that's how you learn.
Our first time is up for the first half of episode 4 of the Mastermind of a DJ podcast. It's Nari Natalia, and trust me, there is more where this came from with Ivano Bellini, and you can get the extra exclusive content all by signing up to be part of our community online right now at mmofadj.com. And if you have any feedback from this or other episodes of the podcast, I want to hear from you. That's the only way that I can better serve you as a podcaster. Now, I want to give an extra special thanks to Ivano for sharing his story with us, as not many people really get to hear this side of him, and I'm beyond honored to provide that kind of platform. Now, since Mastermind of a DJ podcast is an alliance with Vixen's Cabaret and Groove Cruise, the lineup of interviews from some of the biggest names in dance music is sick. Now, don't forget, coming up this Saturday, October 9th, South Florida's morning show host on Power 96 and powerhouse behind the decks, DJ Zog, is scheduled to tear it up at Vixen's Cabaret. You're going to want to call for table reservations now at 954-649-5795, because it will be a dope event. You definitely don't want to miss it. All right, fam, I just want to thank you so much for listening. And remember, be good to yourself and be good to others. This world needs it, and it needs you. And of course, it needs dance music.
Thank you for listening to the Mastermind of a DJ podcast with Nari Natalia. Follow us on our social media handles at Mastermind of a DJ, or log online at mmofadj.com.